IGGS, Us and Them.
Hello and welcome to our podcast series Us and Them, provided by HGGS, Heidelberg University. So today we are really glad and proud to have as our guest Professor Richard Kaplan from the Oxford University. Welcome, Professor.
Welcome, thank you.
Well, it's an impossible task to explain the background of the professor in a nutshell. I will try my best to just briefly explain the background. Professor Richard Kaplan from the University of Oxford, Professor of International Relationships, and his research interests include international organizations and conflict management, with a particular focus on peacekeeping and post-conflict peace and state building. He is the author and editor of several books, for example, International Governance of War-Torn Territories, Rule and Construction, Exit Strategies and State Building, Measuring Peace, Principles, Practices and Politics. On that point, I have to also recommend you that if you are really interested in these kind of topics, just type in Measuring Peace in YouTube and you will also find some really great presentations of the book by Professor Kaplan. Professor Kaplan is principal investigator of the project After Exit, Assessing the Consequences of United Nations Peacekeeping Withdrawal, which is investigating conditions on the ground in countries that have played host to large-scale UN peacekeeping operations in the five-year period following the closure of these operations. He is also the co-investigator of the Oxford Martin School-funded program on Transboundary Resource Management, which is exploring the scope of for cross border cooperation on natural resource management in the Eastern Nile River Basin and Israel, Palestine, and Jordan, where growing pressures on water and energy threaten regional destabilization. He is a member of the World Food Program, Peace Evidence Experts Research Group, and a member of the Folke Bernadotte Academy's International Research Working Group on Peacekeeping. And as the last information, he was also our guest yesterday on the 27th of June in our summer forum, Us and Them, with the keynote lecture, Saving Strangers, the False Promise of Responsibility to Protect. So, as an first informal question, I'd like to ask, did you enjoy the event of the forum yesterday?
Very much. And I was very, very impressed with the multidisciplinary aspect of the event. It was an excellent theme, a very topical theme. And as I said, what was very interesting was that there were presentations from a wide range of disciplines. And that's often not the case because many of us tend to work in silos in a disciplinary sense. So we work among scholars of our own discipline. So it was very, very nice to hear perspectives from different disciplines.
Well, thank you for your kind remarks about our organization. And also, we'd like to thank you again for your insightful keynote speech in our forum. So maybe as the second informal question, we're all wondering about what was your motivation when you first approached these kind of topics, these controversial topics, including the UN peacekeeping operations and also measuring pieces, just before you maybe started your doctorate program. What was your inner motivation?
So I'm very interested in scholarly questions that arise from very broadly international organizations and conflict management. And increasingly, I have focused on the challenges that conflict-affected states face emerging from violent conflict and the challenge international organizations working with those states face in achieving a recovery from achieving a sustainable peace. But I'm the sort of person, and this isn't something I'm prescriptive about, I'm the sort of person who also likes working at the interface of public policy and scholarship. So a lot of the research that I do, a lot of the scholarship I'm engaged in has implications for public policy, and I like to work with organizations where it's possible. Sometimes I've been approached by different parts of the United Nations, for instance, to assist them with their thinking and their development of policy, or to share the research findings of some of the work that I'm doing. This is not me alone. A lot of my colleagues have also participated in exercises of this kind. And I derive satisfaction from knowing that some of the work that I'm doing has broader application. But again, as I said, I also admire the work of colleagues who are more narrowly, if you will, focused on academic questions only, and that's fine. It's just a personal choice.
I think that's the most important part of the academic career, that you have this feeling of satisfaction with what you are doing. So that would be a great advice for the future academic people to follow their passion, maybe.
Absolutely. I mean, where it is possible, of course. I mean, sometimes we do have to conform to demands, requirements that aren't always of our own choosing. That's very, very clear. But yes, I think that you have to be mindful of what it is that interests you, and to pursue to the best of your ability, to design to the best of your ability research projects that reflect those interests.
Sure. Thank you, Professor. So, starting to delve into the basics, fundamentals of this topic, saving strangers, the false promise of responsibility to protect.
And can I mention, by the way,
what
our listeners cannot see is that false promise is in inverted commas.
True.
So I'm raising a question about whether it is a false promise. You cannot hear the inverted commas. You can only see them on the title of the talk.
Actually, that's the maybe disadvantage of having a podcast, but another visual one. So we cannot really show our audience that we are asking these questions. But thanks for your clarification. So it's more clarified right now. But maybe providing some background information about the UN peacekeeping operations. I think that also you also share the opinion that the turning point was UN peacekeeping operations in Somalia after the civil war, and UN intervened in that situation, which we haven't seen in that scope before, I guess. So what was the situation before, and why do we consider this UN's intervention in Somalia as a turning point?
So for a very long time, and I'm talking about going back to the early days since the establishment of the United Nations in 1945, there was a prohibition, and it's reflected in the words of the Charter, of intervening in what is considered to be domestic matters of a state. And that was to protect states from outside interference. It wasn't always respected, but the Charter does provide the possibility for that protection. But it also meant that state governments, leaders, were often at liberty to treat their populations as they wished. And horrible things were done to peoples. I talked in my presentation about the attack on East Pakistanis when East Pakistan was seeking greater autonomy within Pakistan, and how that led to a very significant violence, repression, and produced an outpouring of refugees to India, and how India then intervened militarily, how in Cambodia under Pol Pot, similarly, there was a very dire situation, and millions of Cambodians under that regime suffered. And again, Vietnam intervened. In both cases, the countries were motivated principally by strategic reasons. But in the case of East Pakistan, which ultimately became the independent state of Bangladesh, India did invoke humanitarian reasons as well. But that was not supported. That was not considered to be an acceptable basis for intervention. Indeed, there was a strong sense that humanitarian intervention was unlawful. precisely because there was concern that it could be abused as a pretext for intervening for strategic, economic, political reasons, and indeed historically that was the case. But what happened, going back to the case of Somalia, Somalia had descended into total anarchy when civil war broke out in 1988 there, and by 1992, there was no central governing authority. There was a terrible humanitarian situation, famine, disease, widespread displacement of peoples within the country and outside the country. And the United Nations was providing humanitarian assistance, but that assistance was in effect being hijacked by rebel forces, and they were using humanitarian aid for the purpose of earning income, and that income was used in part to purchase weapons that were then further fueling the civil war. So an extraordinary debate took place within the United Nations Security Council, where the members of the council, to a state, all 15 members, concurred that this was a threat to international peace and security. That in itself was not unprecedented, actually. There had been recognition, and I didn't talk about this in the lecture yesterday, but in northern Iraq, when under Saddam Hussein, his forces were engaged in violence against the Kurds in northern Iraq, and Britain led a humanitarian relief effort there. It included a no-fly zone, so a military intervention. But the difference between that and Somalia is that that effort on behalf of the northern Iraqi Kurds was not authorized by the Security Council, although they did use the language of threat to international peace and security, so they recognized that. But in the case of Somalia, for the first time, there was authorization to use force if necessary to assist with the provision of humanitarian aid. And the members of the Security Council, when they voted in support of this action, stressed that this was a unique situation and that it required an exceptional response. So the thinking was this was a one-off. This was not going to become, if you will, a pattern. But in fact, it established a precedent. And on the basis of that precedent, the United Nations now had available to it, you could say, a tool that would allow it to authorize the use of military force for the purpose of providing humanitarian assistance, for responding to a humanitarian emergency, and there would be subsequent uses of or authorization of the use of military force for that reason in years to follow.
Actually, related with that topic, I think before the Somalia case, we had this, I would call it as a problem of exception is the rule in the UN Charter, so that it could be really misused or misinterpreted by the related countries, so that it wasn't really effective anymore. So with the Somalia case, can we say that it has changed so that UN has an opportunity to intervene, hopefully at the right time, in these kind of humanitarian problems?
Yes, I would say that is a shift that occurred. So the exception proving the rule, the exception was the use by, in the cases I mentioned, India and Vietnam, the use of military force for strategic purposes primarily, but that had humanitarian dividend. But it was the international reaction, condemnation of India and Vietnam, that demonstrated that the rule against the prohibition military force for humanitarian purposes, to intervene for humanitarian purposes, was indeed the rule. And that is what changed. And it was not an overnight change. I mean, there were developments along the way. I mentioned, for instance, the growing recognition that a domestic situation can have implications for international peace and security. That was already a change, a recognition that security was broader than the notion of national security, that it also entailed human security. And that spoke to the condition of individuals within a state. And that was also a development over time that occurred that facilitated the kind of shift that we're talking about.
And moving on to another challenge that UN is currently facing and has already faced, that term which was actually categorized by Kofi Annan, dilemma of humanitarian intervention. Would you like to elaborate on that problem and maybe brief solution? How can we overcome this problem?
So what happened after Somalia in a couple of years that followed was a genocide in Rwanda, 1994, that resulted in the slaughter of up to 800,000 people. And the UN had a small presence in Rwanda at the time, a peacekeeping presence. But notwithstanding the fact that there were warning signs, including from the UN on the ground itself, of an impending catastrophe, we didn't know at the time, of course, the magnitude that it would achieve, the UN decided to reduce the size of the presence and also to narrow the scope of the mandate so that force could be used only in self-defense and not to prevent violence. So the UN force there was ill-equipped, both in terms of resources and in terms of mandate. And the consequence was, as I said, this genocide on a scale that was just inconceivable in a very short period of time. And following that, we had in Srebrenica, in Bosnia and Herzegovina, the following year in July, the Bosnian safe area by the UN's own efforts. It established six safe areas within Bosnia and Herzegovina. These were defended by the United Nations peacekeeping forces, and they were meant to be humanitarian protection zones. And the safe area of Srebrenica in eastern Bosnia and Herzegovina was overrun by Bosnian Serbs, and 8,000 Bosnian boys and men were slaughtered at that time. And so the dilemma that you're talking about that Kofi Annan tried to articulate was, well, one last episode, which you need to understand this dilemma. When then, in 1998, it appeared that there was another humanitarian catastrophe on the horizon in Kosovo, the Albanian-majority province of Serbia, where Yugoslavian Serbian forces were using violence to repress the Kosovo-Albanian resistance, which itself was using violence, but they were non-state actors and not to the degree that the Yugoslav and Serbian forces were. The Security Council even recognized that this was an impending humanitarian catastrophe, but the NATO member states decided to use force, initiate a NATO air campaign when negotiations broke down between the parties to the conflict, the Serbs and the Kosovo Albanians, and they did so without authorization of the UN Security Council. So reflecting on these experiences of Rwanda, of Srebrenica, of Kosovo, Kofi Annan articulated this humanitarian intervention dilemma, and he said, what are we to do? What are we to do when, on the one hand, the international community stands on the sidelines and does not take action, does not engage to prevent or mitigate violence in a situation like Rwanda? Certainly that's not acceptable. But on the other hand, nor is it acceptable that states take the decision without authorization by the UN Security Council to engage in an effort to prevent or mitigate a humanitarian disaster. And the reason why the United States and other France, Britain on the Security Council did not bring this matter to the Security Council is because they knew correctly that Russia and China would veto any authorization by the Security Council, any attempt to authorize the use of force by NATO for this purpose. So they acted illegally. NATO acted illegally, but recognizing that not to act could have resulted in humanitarian crisis. So this was the dilemma which he said that the United Nations faced, and what he said is what we need is agreement on the criteria on which basis the United Nations can and should take action, but also a consensus on the modalities that would govern the action that the Security Council would authorize. And all of that culminated in the adoption some 6 years later in what is known as the Responsibility to Protect Doctrine or Norm.
We have mentioned until that point actually the cases which were maybe a little bit familiar to our listeners, but there are some unseen atrocities, at least through the lens of the Western media or Western world. Which role should UN play actually in terms of preventing these unseen atrocities? Because we as an audience were shocked actually to hear about the number of atrocities that we have not known actually, and which was actually non-visible in the Western media. So what should be UN's role in preventing these atrocities?
So scores of atrocities have taken place, mass atrocities. When I talk about mass atrocities, I mean genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, that, as you say, do not reach always the attention of the public. And they will only, the UN Security Council can only act on them if the Security Council agrees to put them on its agenda. And it does not always agree to do that for many different reasons. And one of them, of course, is where members of the Security Council, members of the Permanent Five Security Council, have an interest. So this is where geopolitics come into play. So Russia was a supporter of Assad's Syria, and so Russia was very careful to avoid any movement towards authorizing the Security Council to take robust measures in response to Syria. We've seen also that the United States has come to the defense of Israel in Gaza, China with regard to Myanmar. They all have interests, and those interests prevent the United Nations sometimes from acting. And this is a structural weakness, you could say, of the United Nations, but it's an inevitable weakness because you cannot abolish the veto. And what can be done, an attempt was made by the French in a proposal many years ago to agree a voluntary suspension of the use of the veto in cases involving a humanitarian crisis. But that was not accepted by the other members of the Security Council, primarily the Permanent Five members, and so there is no such suspension of the veto for that purpose. I think it's important to understand that the responsibility to protect populations is first and foremost the responsibility of states, of the states whose populations are at risk. And that is also what distinguishes responsibility to protect from historic ideas about humanitarian intervention. It's not a right to intervene. It is conceived of as a right of a responsibility of a sovereign power. So it is an enlarged understanding of sovereignty. Sovereignty doesn't give states license to do whatever they want. It also entails responsibilities, and one of those responsibilities is to not engage in mass atrocity crimes against one's own people. And the United Nations has a responsibility to remind states of the responsibility they have, also to assist states where they can, where states are willing to receive that assistance. And it's only when states are unable or unwilling to do anything about mass atrocity crimes that the UN may authorize the use of military action against these states. But it has to be a practical decision. I mean, the problem sometimes is that the situation might be dire, but it's not obvious how a military situation, military response would improve. It might, in fact, aggravate, exacerbate the situation. How do you intervene effectively, for instance? But there are other things that can be done. It's very, very important, thinking from the ground up, that civic organizations, both within countries and outside countries, transnational, non-governmental organizations, are providing monitoring of situations so that the public is informed. You mentioned earlier mass atrocity crimes that haven't come to the attention of the public internationally. It's very important that we are aware, and they can play a role. Increasingly with social media, it becomes easier to do that in some respects. Also to mobilize governments within countries and again from the outside to respect their obligations, because these are obligations that states have to refrain from engaging in crimes of this nature. But then, states, as I said, the Security Council has a responsibility to react, and it can do so in various ways. Only in extremis, using military force, if military force can help to alleviate the situation. But sometimes even highlighting the problem and their reputational costs, which states may wish to avoid. They don't want to be in the limelight if they're responsible for crimes of this kind. States outside the Security Council, outside the United Nations, can act unilaterally in the sense that they have, many of them, relations with countries in question. They can moderate their trade relations, for instance, to bring pressure to bear on countries. We've seen that taking place within, with respect to the war between UK and Russia, that members of the European Union and non-members of the European Union are participating in sanctions efforts against Russia in reaction to Russia's aggression against Ukraine. These are not sanctions that have been authorized by the Security Council because, again, as a permanent member of the Council, Russia is not going to agree to such measures be adopted. So these are efforts that are taken outside of the United Nations, but in support of international norms, international laws. The aggression is, a cornerstone principle of the UN Charter is that states will not use force against other states or even threaten to use force against other states in any way that will violate the territorial integrity of a state or its political independence. And clearly that is what has happened in this particular case. So there are things that can be done. But I'm not in any way trying to suggest that it's an easy battle.
Sure. Actually, we are trying to approach this problem with our knowledge that we actually possess. But it's a great challenge to change these hierarchical structures and also relationships between the countries. So I would like to ask, building on your remarks about the inner politics and between state politics in the framework of the UN, I think it will be fair to say that we are experiencing some fragile times with the increase of nationalism and far-right movements, which could also affect the politics of the UN and also funding of the UN. What would be your recommendation in terms of overcoming the actual problems, current problems that the UN, and maybe in a more analogically more broader framework, that the international peacekeeping organizations can face nowadays?
Well, I think the UN can only be as effective as its member states allow it to be. And the problem that we're facing today is declining cooperation among member states, a return, you could say, of geopolitics. And that brief period after the Cold War, where we saw major powers working together, or at least not resisting efforts to achieve positive outcomes, dealing with challenges to regional and international peace and security, those days are in the past. I mean, not entirely. It's not as if the UN is not able to be effective in any respect. It still has a very important role to play with regard to the delivery of humanitarian aid, with regard to the care and maintenance of refugees. But it has been more peripheral with regard to the management of violent conflict itself in many of these cases. And it's really very, very difficult to do anything about that. I mean, we have to hope that we return to a period where major powers recognize that it's in everybody's interest, including their own, to be constructive, working together to address the challenges that we face, not only with regard to violent conflict, but in many other areas as well, including the challenges of climate change, for instance. I think that the United Nations has to continue to issue the warning signals about the dangers of inaction, the dangers of not exercising the responsibility that these states have, again, especially as permanent members of the Security Council. The United Nations is also facing a challenge with the Trump administration, which has moved away from support, U.S. support for multilateralism. It's pursuing an America First policy, and it has made very clear that it doesn't see a value in a lot of the things that the United Nations does. It prefers to act either unilaterally, but not reliant on seeking the cooperation of other states, although again, there are very compelling reasons to try to meet these challenges in a multilateral fashion. It gives greater legitimacy to them. It actually reduces the burden on states that are serious about trying to solve these problems. So it really doesn't make sense to abandon, in many respects, the United Nations. Notwithstanding complaints about bloated bureaucracies, you will always hear these complaints, but it's actually, in many respects, a very cost-effective, cost-efficient way of dealing. Peacekeeping is a lot cheaper than picking up the pieces after peace has collapsed entirely. I mean, again, you compare the costs of the unsuccessful efforts in Afghanistan against the more successful efforts. And I'm not trying to say that all peacekeeping efforts have been successful, but certainly there have been there's been a lot of progress made under UN peacekeeping efforts. So there have been times historically when the United Nations has been more central in efforts to deal with global problems in times when it has been pushed to the margins to an extent. And you know, we can only hope that we will return one day to a time when there's greater recognition of the value of working through the United Nations. And again, I'm not suggesting that that doesn't mean that there's no scope for the UN to reform its ways, to try to be more responsive. But I don't think that the problem lies first and foremost with the organization. I think it's more to do with where we are in this time as far as I said, the geopolitical shifts, the move away for also for support for a rules-based international order on the part of many of the key powers in the world today.
I really like the idea that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, so there is no reason to be full pessimistic about the future. But maybe as a last challenging question, that would be a methodological question to our formal part. You also mentioned about the, maybe I can interpret as a credibility problem because of the past actions of the UN and also this inner political problems. And one of the solutions, if I also interpret it correctly, that you like to bring on the table is that there are some competent regional authorities that we can rely on, because some problems that occurred in the international politics stems from the fact that these international organizations try to impose some one-size-fits-all solutions, which does not really actually align with the reality of the current problem happening on this region. So can we rely on these regional organizations in peacekeeping operations? Would it be a correct way to direct our solution to these problems?
Well, I think that there's room for regional organizations to play a greater role. They have, in fact, been playing a greater role over the last 10 years, increasingly in maintenance of international peace and security in their regions. And I'm talking about the African Union. I'm talking about even sub-regional organizations, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, the European Union, even ASEAN in a more modest way, have all been engaged in efforts regionally to deal with problems in their own neighborhood. And it makes sense to rely on them to a certain extent because they have a natural interest and therefore a commitment to seeing through their engagement. I mean, the problem that the United Nations has sometimes faced is that as that a crisis comes on the agenda, the Security Council might deal with it if it falls in the area of international peace and security, but then another crisis will come and compete, or that crisis will subside in its intensity, and it doesn't receive the sustained interest and support that it requires in order to achieve a satisfactory outcome, whereas regional organizations are sometimes willing to stay with a crisis or a conflict-affected situation because they recognize that it needs sustained support in order to bring it to a satisfactory outcome. The problem, however, with regional organizations, well, twofold. First of all, they're not all of one kind. And the greatest number of conflict situations have arisen on the African continent, but the African Union, for instance, is limited in terms of the resources that it has to deal with these crises. So unlike, for instance, the European Union, which is a richer regional organization, and perhaps has resources, doesn't have quite the same resource challenges that the African Union might have. So if one is to rely on these regional organizations, one has to ensure that they're properly resourced, properly trained as well, and trained to standard that is, let us call it an international standard, that the forces, for instance, have to be trained to respect norms of, you know, international rights, international humanitarian law, and so forth. But the other thing is that, if you will, the flip side of having an interest and therefore an enduring, possibly, commitment to a situation is that you can have an interest in a negative way as well, which is to say that these are countries that are neighbors and therefore they want to see the situation perhaps evolve in a particular way that speaks to their interests. And that's one reason why historically UN peacekeeping has not involved the major powers, the troops on the ground, because the idea was that they would have interest all of, particularly during the Cold War, interest all over the world. And so better to keep them out of these situations. There were exceptions. Cyprus was one, for instance. But, you know, by and large, that has been the case. And you can see the problem with the management, the League of Arab States management of the Lebanese civil war, where Syria was given a mandate to intervene and to bring an end to the fighting there, which it did successfully. But then it really never left, and it continued to meddle in Lebanese affairs until really very, very recently. And that has had very deleterious effects for the development of Lebanon. So it's two sides of the coin.
Thanks, Professor Kaplan, for your informative and really insightful remarks about this controversial topic. We were really glad that you accepted to join us. As traditionally, I'd like to also pose you one last informal question, because you have a professorship position in the University of Oxford, which is also a student city, and Heidelberg is also a student city, actually. I don't know if you have time to visit the city. What would be your first impressions about when you compare these two student cities, and did you like your experience in Heidelberg, actually, as a student city?
Well, I've only just arrived and have only just seen a little of the city, but from what I've seen, it is a beautiful city, much like Oxford is in a beautiful city as well. And the university plays a very important role in the city, again, like Oxford, the university there does too. And I'm looking forward to discovery over the next couple of days that I'm able to enjoy what Heidelberg has to offer.
Thank you so much, Professor. So we have come to the end of our recording of the podcast series, and we'll see you again in the next episodes.
Thank you. Been a pleasure to spend time with you today.
Bye.